Today, the PGA Championship takes place this weekend, and it does so against the backdrop of a global golf gate that makes our little golf gate in Clifton look like a teddy bear's picnic. The professional game of golf finds itself mired in controversy as a Saudi-backed breakaway tournament called the LIV Golf Invitational Series is consumed and beset by claims of controversy and sports washing. Fionn Davenport, the award-winning travel writer and co-host of the very popular Golf Weekly podcast on Off the Ball, is here to explain all to us. Fionn, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Mandy.
Now, before you shed your wisdom on all of this, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about a new term that slipped into the sporting lexicon, the issue of sports washing. Can you just explain to our listeners exactly what it is and give us a few examples of it?
Sports washing is a way that a regime that would be seen in an unsavory light by, you know, the general thrust of Western society. It's their attempt to legitimize their regime using sport as a way of kind of finding favor with a general audience. So the most obvious examples in recent years has been the attempts of the United Arab Emirates. So you have the UAE, which bought Manchester City in 2010 and have engaged in what is, frankly, an incredibly successful example of it. In that they, you know, they have a very successful club. They've spent an awful lot of money in the local community in Manchester. It's followed by Qatar, who have done the same by investing in Barcelona. They are the owners of Paris Saint-Germain. And then latterly, and this is what we're going to talk about now, it's the Saudis. So the Saudis have followed suit. They've seen the examples of their neighbours in the Middle East. And they have engaged in perhaps the biggest example of sports washing of all, in that, you know, they've attracted Formula One to the kingdom. There's boxing bouts to the kingdom. And the other one is golf. So golf is the latest field upon which they attempt to find legitimacy or to find favour outside of their borders and say, look, we are okay. So despite the fact that Amnesty would be hypercritical of Saudi regime, is that it's their way of just kind of normalizing the kingdom in the eyes of the world.
And we can be critical of the countries and we can be critical of the sponsorships, but we should also take a look at the sports stars themselves. Like, I read some extraordinary figures for David Beckham and his ambassadorship for Qatar for the World Cup, like 200 million to be ambassador for the country. I mean, you know, there's a sense, isn't there, that the, like, how much is enough for these type of players? It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, I mean that's obviously is the most legitimate. You know, that's a very legitimate criticism, is that, and those that take the money of these so-called unsavory regimes are criticized precisely on that basis.
Welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. That sound will be familiar to anyone who grew up in Ireland in the 1980s when we had one holiday per year and it was a very big deal. I wonder if things have gone full circle now as energy prices, carbon taxes and COVID-19 all take their toll on the cost of travel. Well, to discuss the issue, I'm joined now in studio by Paul Hackett, who is CEO of Click & Go, and on the line by journalist and broadcaster Simon Calder and host of the excellent podcast You Should Have Been There. Paul and Simon, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mandy.
Very welcome. Pleasure to be here.
Paul, I might start off with you by looking at the Irish market first of all. Is it fair to say that 2022 will be a normal year? Are we back to 2019 levels? Where are the biggest destinations for Irish holidaymakers this year?
Normal would be wonderful, but I don't think we're going to get to normal in Ireland this year. Most of the travel businesses are forecasting somewhere between 75 to 80% of 2019 levels. It has been a very fluctuating year in terms of where things were. Like, it's only January since testing was dropped. It's only late January since
there was... So 80% is not bad at all, is
it? It's not bad because there was nothing booking in 21 for 22 in Ireland.
You know, just because somebody describes it as a poll, you know, there's a difference between a poll carried out by Red Sea and a poll carried out by, you know, whatever, Acme polls, you know, we don't know who they are. We don't know what their methodology is. So, I mean, the media organizations have a responsibility to be sure that the content that's been offered to them is genuine and legitimate. And if somebody's describing it as a poll, it has to have, you know, a sample size. It has to have demographic balances that the recognizable polling companies all build into their systems.
And I have to say, there is that robustness behind most of the polling that's done here in Ireland, which gives it a credibility. I see you nodding there, Richard.
Yeah, there is. But it is really important point, actually, because there is more and more of kind of, you know, people doing their own polls on Twitter or whatever else and giving it some
and
credence.
And using that,
because
yeah.
It has, you know, 20,000 people answered their poll and isn't this amazing? But if it's 20,000 people who are all the same type of people who live in a certain part of the country, then it's not really relevant. You know, you have to control that sample. The quality is so important in terms of what you're getting out of it. And I 100% agree about, you know, that there is an onus on journalists, you know, to actually check the credibility of the stuff that's being sent to them. I mean, we're part of an organization called AIMRO, which represents all of the serious market research companies in Ireland. And actually on the AIMRO website, there's 10 questions journalists should ask, or anyone should ask, about a poll before they believe the results or take them seriously.
Yeah,
and I think that's important.
That's exactly the point I was trying to get to, is I think there needs to be more transparency about who's commissioned the report and what the sample size is, and not just kind of use it as a given without fact checking before. I think there's a lot more of that coming into the news cycle that maybe before wouldn't have gotten through.
I think you're right. And I think it almost goes back to, you know, a lot of exercises like yourselves, you know, who do fact checking exercises on pieces that are out there. But you know, it's really important in polling as well that, you know, just because someone says, oh, X percent of people say this, you know, is that true? Is it a reliable company that's done that research, and have they done it properly?
Stephen, we leave the final word on this to you. I just want to go back to politics for a moment. Are politicians using this behind the scenes more than they have before? Is there any sense that they've embraced this culture of market research themselves?
Oh, very much so. We know that all the political parties use various blends of quantitative and qualitative, research. Like the focus groups are a popular tool, I think, you know, I know Sinn Féin have used some commercial polling, but I think they also have their own panels that they had focus groups. I know when they had in the Dublin Midwest by-election, when there were four by-elections before the last general election, so we're talking about the autumn of 2019, they had panels, like focus group panels, where they would run local issues in local constituencies, be passed a sample group of people. And you know, the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael certainly use polling and market research, and I think Fianna Fáil has used their own kind of blended work. They do some of their own polling, blended with some commercial polling. So, of course, I think back to the tales past. There was one famous political figure, a celebrated political beast in times gone past, who was known to convince certain candidates that maybe it was time for them to move on and let a younger colleague take up the colours by producing research that showed their seat was in danger. But I'm not too sure if the provenance of the authenticity of some of the research that was used to convince the elder statesmen to move on.
Well, God forbid there'd be that type of chicanery going on in the background of politics. For now, we'll have to leave it there. Yeah, just that question of why you came into the Irish market then is quite interesting to me. You know, the Irish market is very strong, you know, in terms of media presence already. It's very competitive. But the national and regional papers struggling a bit, and some would refer to that press industry as a sort of sunset industry. So was it because it was a great bargain, and was that why you looked at it?
It was a combination. It's clear that we looked at several markets, also outside Ireland, obviously. But here we had a chance, and we thought it's a small market, That's a bit, as I said, the size of the markets we know. And we thought the company was very interesting because lots of people say it's a sunset market, but in Belgium and the Netherlands, we're doing better than ever in the history. And the history also there goes back 150 years because we're trying to turn print into digital. And there it works very well. And here we saw a market, at least the company, I&M, which was maybe strong in print, but was not strong at all in digital and did not really have a strategy in digital. We didn't have digital subscriptions, for example. So we thought with the knowledge we have and with the experience we have in Belgium and the Netherlands, we can try to bring it to Ireland and try to develop here, even if there's lots of difference, obviously, with the markets we know, but try to develop the company here. And it's true. It's a busy market. We're amazed that the power of RTE is so big here. We're even a little bit unhappy with that. Everywhere you have public services, but here in Ireland, RTE is protected in a very strong way, and sometimes is killing a little bit the entrepreneurship of the sector. But it's things we knew when we came here, and we're here now for almost 3 years. And I have to say, we're further in our plan than we thought we would be by the moment. So we're quite happy with the decision we took in 2019.
Yeah, Peter, I might come back to that transformational change within the group in a moment. Yep. But for now, I'd like to just pick up on those comments you've made about RTE. The government has recently commissioned a report on the future of the media. We've heard it's reported to government, but things have gone very quiet there. What would you like to see from that report? And what would you like to see the government do?
Well, we would like a playing field which is level. Yes, in every market we are in, and yes, in every European market, we have strong public players. And I'm an advocate for strong public players. But strong public players shouldn't harm the private players.
You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston, and we're joined now by Nashreen Sheikh. Nashreen is an international advocate for eradicating modern day slavery. She has an extraordinarily compelling story of how she escaped not only forced marriage, but child labour and extreme poverty, risking everything that she had to experience freedom. And now she's an independent businesswoman. She's a really impactful voice around the world for the 40 million people who remain in modern day slavery. Nashreen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Sadly, our discussions around sustainable fashion very often start on the high street by being critical about chain stores. Seldom, though, do we hear firsthand about those who make those items or make those clothes. You, Nashreen, were the only girl in a Nepalese village of 2000 to ever have avoided the fate of arranged marriage. Can you tell us about your extraordinary journey from that tiny village to the city of Kathmandu, where you worked making textiles and garments?
Yes, when I look back, it feels like my birth makes an absolute miracle that I'm alive and connecting with you and News Talk in Ireland. Just incredible. I was able to escape forced marriage, child labor, and extreme poverty. I come from a very dusty, undocumented village, which is not found on any map or book. A village where children are born onto the floor of their family homes and neither birth or death records are kept. This is where I was born, and I began my journey as an undocumented person. And in my village, every single young girl was being forced into marriage. And when my own older sister was arranged into marriage at the age of 12 years old, that's when I heard from my mom that I will be next. And that's something that really hit me. And in my village, there's no role model. There is, like, it's very, very male-dominated society. Women is completely, you know, suppressed, and their voices are suppressed. So as a young girl, you have nothing to look up to. And for me, it was like all I did is like try to connect a little bit with the nature in the village, but everything around humanity felt very, very oppressive. So my life seemed destined for the same oppressive path. And I think I became a child laborer between the age of 9 or 10. And six of us lived and worked and slept in a 10 by 10 room without a bathroom or access to clean water. I remember that 10 by 10 room, we were splashing cold water on my face, trying to stay awake. And there were moments when I felt like my little fingers were working as fast as the machines. And if we did not meet our deadline, we would not get paid at all. We were forced to work almost every single day for 7 days a week for 10, 12, and sometimes even 15 hours a day. And only then we would receive less than $2 a day. In the sweatshop, we did not even have a bed. So the large pile of clothes that I was making every day, at night, I would fall asleep on those clothes with my colleagues, you know. And sometimes I would dream, like, where these clothes are going to, who would wear them? And because the room was 10 by 10 room, the windows was covered up, the door was locked, and we were six people eating, sleeping, living there. Sometimes it was really hard for me to breathe. And I felt like they were woven, those clothes were woven with the energy of my suffering, like pure suffering, those threads.
Travis, I want to go back to where we started on this one. And if I don't, I think my producer might have a heart attack. He's a big Billy Joel fan. And so we wanted to get your views on what's going on there. How is a figure arrived at? Is it just what the market will pay, or is there a formula? Really, I suppose what I'm asking is, why would Billy Joel's catalogue be worth twice the value of Bruce Springsteen?
I think it's a mixture of things. I think, for one, the market will dictate, you know, a certain number. And then I think it's a negotiation. I think that depending on who is planning on buying Billy Joel's catalogue, if they see a future of using these songs, I mean, I think it's important to remember, once someone owns this, it lasts at least 70 years, most likely 140 years. So once someone has access to these catalogs, and Billy Joel has so many hits, so many familiar songs that have been around for decades and will likely continue to be around, which is a very important thing. And when you're buying a catalog, what is the longevity of this? How long can we use this in movies, TVs, commercials, Peloton, etc.? I think someone might reach the conclusion that it's truly worth that much. And if Billy Joel's holding out, I'm sure they would have liked to get it for the same price, if not less than Bruce Springsteen's. But if he's holding out and says $1 billion, and someone says that seems like a worthwhile investment over the next 100 years, it's a little less surprising than it sounds on its face.
Might be financially rewarding, but emotionally destructive for artists like him. He's got a very pristine body of work. It isn't underused. It's not overused. Do you think that there will be a deal done? Do you think that ultimately he will sell his back catalogue?
It's, you know, it's so hard to speculate, but he did raise that number, and that number is being talked about. So it's hard to imagine, saying this as someone who does not have $1 billion, that if someone were to come to you and offer that sort of money in this moment, where again, this moment that will likely pass, and his music will never be valued at that same height again, it's hard to imagine passing on a deal like that. And when you look at everyone else who has sold, it is his contemporaries, it is his peers. There are not very many artists around his age and around his sort of status that have held out and not sold. So, you know, I can't speculate, but my gut says he probably will.
On a completely unrelated subject, but linked to our next item, which we're going to be talking about, which is the world of work. Joe, can I ask you, you're working for the Financial Times, an Irish journalist working over there. How has your world of work changed over the course of the pandemic?
Well, it's interesting. There's far fewer in-person meetings, even now that the, you know, pandemic is waning a little bit. And that's been the main difficulty, really, because as a journalist, you kind of use off-record meetings to establish trust with people, you know, and it's very hard to do that over a Zoom call. And that's really been the biggest impact for me. It doesn't really matter where I'm working from, whether I'm in the office or at home, but what does matter is meeting people, you know, not over the phone, not over email, not over video conference, but over a drink in a bar. And then 6 months later, you know, they become incredibly helpful for a story you're writing. And I really hope that comes back, but yeah, there is no sign of it coming back in the same way, unfortunately.
That's very interesting, because it is a journalist's equivalent of networking. You can't actually do it and have those side conversations and develop those relationships over Zoom and via technology. It's just not possible.
Really can't.